Hi, Dave Emmer here. This is, for the record, program number 876, the OUNB and the assassination of JFK. This is being recorded on November 20th of the year 2015. In 2 days, on Sunday, November 22nd, we will once again be observing, or some people will be observing, the anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy. What we're going to be doing this evening will be, to a large extent, by way of review. And what we're going to be doing is tying together the past and the present. We have been talking at great length in the last couple of years about the OUNB, that is a Ukrainian fascist organization that was allied with the Third Reich in World War II and then jumped to elements of Western intelligence, including elements of CIA, the BND, and the Galen Organization, elements of MI6, British intelligence. It became a primary element of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, which in turn was a key element of the world, of the former World Anti-Communist League. The ABN was formerly the Committee of Subjugated Nations, formed by Adolf Hitler in 1943. And what we're going to be doing is taking a look at the role of the OUNB in the assassination of JFK. And in turn, we are going to be taking a look at significant areas of overlap between key people involved with a covert operation that took place both in the U.S. and abroad called the Crusade for Freedom. The OUNB became a primary element of the Crusade for Freedom, which at home resulted in the evolution of what was quite literally, really is quite literally, a Nazi wing of the Republican Party, the Republican Ethnic Heritage Outreach Organization, and it also had a foreign component. Some, including our heroic author John Loftus, have dubbed the fascist freedom fighters. In yesterday's program, that was For the Record 875, we took a look at, among other things, the OUNB's post-World War II guerrilla warfare conducted against the former Soviet Union in Ukraine. That was part of the fascist freedom fighters operation abroad. It was conducted under the Office of Policy Coordination, and it was again, inextricably linked with the CFF. There was a domestic component of the CFF, and we are going to be taking a look at how some of the key people who oversaw the CFF, Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon, Alan Dulles, George Bush, those are the key people. We are going to be taking a look at their role in the assassination of President Kennedy as well. This by way of helping to understand the evolution of the political forces that are now manifesting in Ukraine and which also have been manifesting here in the U.S. for a long time. Our first major element of focus is going to be actions taken by the WACCFL, that it was the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation, which in 1967 formally coalesced into the former World Anti-Communist League. And we're going to be taking a look at how the assassination of OUNB head Stefan Bandera by a fellow named Bogdan Stashinsky, Stashinsky, was used to link Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald, falsely, not only to the KGB, but also to an alleged KGB/communist assassination plot against JFK. This, in turn, was part of a larger gambit that attempted to link Lee Harvey Oswald to, again, an international communist conspiracy. Oswald was a U.S. intelligence agent. The evidence is very firm that he didn't kill anybody. He was a lousy shot. The paraffin tests on him were negative. He had supposedly fired 3 shots from a rifle and several more from a handgun to kill Officer J.B. Tippit. And yet the nitrate, he had no nitrate residue on him, which is simply ridiculous. Beyond that, the official version of the assassination is ludicrous. Oswald supposedly defected to the Soviet Union, first going to Switzerland on October 15th of 1959, the same day that Stefan Bandera, the head of the OUNB, was assassinated by Bogdan Stashinsky. Stashinsky later confessed to the killing. We will take a look at how elements of the WACCFL, later coalescing into the World Anti-Communist League, were inextricably linked with the trial of Bogdan Stashinsky. And we're also going to take a look at then how this was used to help frame Lee Harvey Oswald. Oswald had supposedly defected to the former Soviet Union, with, among other things, top secret information about the U-2 and about our radar defense nets. And yet, he not only wasn't prosecuted, he wasn't even debriefed by the CIA. He was met instead upon his very smooth return to the U.S. by a guy named Spaz T. Rakin, who was the head of the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. Oswald then began hanging around with fiercely anti-communist white Russians themselves, associated with U.S. and Western intelligence, with the Galen Org, with the ABN, and then also began hanging out with anti-Castro Cubans. He was supposedly a pro Castro communist. He was the only member of the New Orleans Fair Play for Cuba Committee, a pro-Castro organization, and yet the address for his organization, or really for him, was the same as the Guy Bannister Detective Agency, which was a front, an intelligence front, for the clandestine CIA operations against Fidel Castro. And again, the supposed communist Oswald went to work for, among other firms, Jaggers Chiles Stovall. That was a firm that did classified map work for the U.S. military, including apparently for the U-2. He also went to work for the Riley Coffee Company in New Orleans. William B. Riley, who headed up that company, had a long-standing relationship with the CIA and with the anti-Castro program. The alleged KGB / Bogdan Stashinsky / Lee Harvey Oswald connection was part of how Oswald was painted red, and this was part of the misinformation or disinformation trail that was established around Lee Harvey Oswald. We're going to begin with an excerpt from AFA program number 15, the second of two AFA programs about the former World Anti-Communist League, and this material is from an unpublished manuscript by the brilliant Berkeley professor Peter Dale Scott. This program was recorded in March of 1986, and in addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, whose on-air assistance with the broadcast duties was fundamental to the execution of the AFA programs.
He also asserted that his real name was Bogdan Stashinsky. And that's a name that's going to come up several times. So Bogdan Stashinsky is the man, the claimed real name of this man who showed up at the West Berlin CID. And that he was a Ukrainian, born in 1931 in a village near Lvov. Since 1951, he had been an agent of the KGB, and in 1955, he had infiltrated the Ukrainian anti-communist OUN in West Berlin. After all this had been taken down by the policeman, Lehman Stashinsky made a startling deposition. He said that on October 10, 1957, he had killed Lev Rebet, one of the Ukrainian leaders in the entrance to the offices of the newspaper Ukrainsky Samostnik in Munich by firing from a gas pistol a phial containing 5 cubic centimeters of hydrocyanic acid into Rebet's face. He then calmly added that 2 years later, October 15, 1959, he had murdered the leader of OUN, Stefan Bandera, in exactly the same manner. His KGB superiors had ordered him to return to Moscow from East Berlin, but he was afraid that he would have to carry out yet more of such assignments and had decided to give himself up. The German policemen who listened to this fantastic story believed not one word of it. They realized that the man was an East European, probably a Ukrainian, and that his papers in the name of Lehmann were false. They knew of the sudden deaths of Rebet and Bandera in Munich, but in both cases investigations had resulted in a verdict of death by natural causes, though under strange circumstances. Rebet had been found lifeless in the entrance hall of his office in Munich's Karlsplatz, still clutching an attaché case. The doctors stated that he had died of heart failure. Bandera, the Ukrainian leader who had worked for the British SIS, then during the war for the Nazis, and afterwards again for the British Secret Service and CIA in Germany, was found dead in front of the door of his apartment in Zeppelinstrasse in Munich. In his case, protracted investigations were carried out, since it was accepted that he might have been murdered, but no injury of any kind was found, nor was poisoning established, and the pathologist pronounced death from natural causes, namely heart failure. Stashinsky demanded to be handed over to American intelligence, and the German police chiefs gladly obliged. Investigations were conducted for several weeks by American CIC and Special Investigation Branch officers who distrusted Stashinsky's incredible confession and suspected him of being a Soviet agent provocateur, or provoking agent. Eventually, he was handed over to the German police, and BFV officers began to check his descriptions of his movements in 1957 and 1959. They found them to be accurate. Stashinsky also produced various documents, including a diploma of the award of the Order of the Red Banner, which he said he had been given for the murder of Bandera. Entries in his handwriting were found in the register of the Hotel Stachus in Munich, where he had stayed before killing Lev Rebet. And he produced a broken key, the wrenched part of which was found still embedded in the lock of the door of Bandera's apartment. He gave the investigators a description of the murder weapons, which catapulted glass phials filled with cyanic acid. He told them how he had swallowed anti-poison capsules given him in Moscow in order to immunize the effect of the deadly vapor by which his victims were killed. Experts confirmed that hydrocyanic acid could cause immediate death if squirted at the victim's mouth and nostrils, and that after paralyzing the heart, it would leave no trace. The investigations were conducted with the greatest secrecy, and no announcement of Stashinsky's arrest and confessions was made. Early in October, however, a BFV official telephoned Felfa at Pulak, informing him of the amazing case and asking for his advice on some aspects of the prisoner's statements about KGB officials in Moscow who, Stashinsky said, had given him instructions and the murder weapons. Felfa immediately informed the Karlshorst KGB office of Stashinsky's arrest and the progress of the investigations in Munich and Bonn. The Russians began preparations for a propaganda counteroffensive. On October 13th, 2 days after the Federal Ministry of the Interior issued the first official announcement about the strange murders to which Stashinsky had confessed, the press officer of Prime Minister Grotewohl called a press conference in East Berlin, to which West Berlin journalists and correspondents of American, British, and other foreign newspapers were invited.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com. Also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Now, before I read this part, let me just mention, it's hard to keep an open mind in these things because Cookridge himself is a real admirer of Reinhard Gehlen, and he uses words like the Soviets began a propaganda blitz. Now, this is not to say that it might not have been just that, but the fact that basically throughout this book, the operations of Gehlen and his people, most of them ex-Nazis and completely unabashed ex-Nazis, are viewed through the through rose-colored glasses, and the KGB and the Soviet Union is viewed through the eyes of somebody who regards them as an implacable and dangerous enemy at all times. So, again, you have to bear that particular focus in mind. However, it does make the book even more useful because nobody can accuse Cookridge of being a knee-jerk liberal or a leftist pansy or anything like that.
Now, a couple of notes here. Referring back to information carried in past archive shows. Now, we looked at a key Galen agent named Theodore Oberlander in our last Wackle show, and we also looked at his link-ups with Bunker Hunt. Now, Bunker Hunt of the John Birch Society, Bunker Hunt involved with the Kennedy assassination, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 11. And one of the things that Bunker Hunt was involved with, in turn, was a group which he was going to name the American Volunteer Group, which, interestingly enough, was also the name of General Claire Chennault's Flying Tigers in Japan, John Birch having been the intelligence advisor to Chennault at one point. And what Bunker Hunt was proposing, and we read some material from a book called Spooks by James Hogan, was setting up, basically, assassination squads in the United States. The aforementioned American Volunteer Group was to be the name, recruited from General Edwin Walker's John Birch Society cell in Dallas. Now, of course, we looked at Walker's links with Nazis both in this country and in Germany in our Radio Free America series number 11. Walker, a former nationalist Chinese military advisor, okay, going back to the China lobby, the MacArthur Group, and so forth, again from Aryan nations. Now, the murder weapon, which was going to be used by the American Volunteer Groups, was described as a gas gun developed in Germany, which would leave the victims, its victims, having a look like they had apparently died of heart attacks, and it would squirt hydrocyanic acid at the victims. The murder weapon sounding very, very much like what this Bogdan Stashinsky says he used on Bandera, and which may have been used on Bandera. The question is, who used it? And, of course, remember the Galen, Oberlander, Wackel, ABN, Bunker Hunt link. Bunker Hunt connected with Oberlander in a group called the Committee for the Preservation of Christian Culture. The Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, CDCC.
Okay, continuing on with the press conference. At the conference, a former Galen agent, Stefan Lippholz, was produced. He was a German, he said, born in 1907 at Staraya Alexandrovska in Volnia in Russia. Volhynia in Russia. In 1939, he had come to Germany, where he fought in Hitler's army and, because of his knowledge of the Russian language, was eventually posted to Schellenberg's Militaramt and became a liaison officer to the Vlasov Army. The Vlasov Army was a white Russian army fighting on the side of the Germans, which itself later became involved in a series of spy scandals.
And Galen and Oberlander, key people with the Vlasov Army, also the NTS, as we're about to see. Walter Schellenberg was head of the Sicherheitsdienst, Overseas Intelligence Branch, the Sicherheitsdienst being the SS intelligence service.
After the war, Lippholz lived for a time in East Germany, then went to West Berlin and eventually joined the Galen organization, where he was ordered to recruit Ukrainians and Bielorussians for training as parachutists to be infiltrated into the Soviet Union. Remember, Stefan Bandera and his group were Ukrainian. He told at length of his work for the ORG and how he became the landlord of the Stephansklause Inn in Munich, one of Galen's many fronts, and the meeting place of the ORG's agents and V-men. His superiors at Pulak were Roman Henlinger, formerly with Himmler's RSHA, and Yaroslav Sulima, a Ukrainian who was in charge of training the parachutists. Lippholz stated that Galen had watched Bandera's activities on behalf of the British Secret Intelligence Service with misgivings. In 1956, Bandera and two of his aides, Voskovich and Benzal, were training Ukrainian agents whom the British intended to infiltrate into the Soviet Union by the way of Austria. Galen, according to Lippholz, wanted to foil the British plans, for he regarded them as dangerous competition to his own activities for CIA. Lippholz was ordered to approach Bandera's two lieutenants and persuade them to relinquish their work for the SIS and join Galen's newly established BND. They were offered twice the pay they were receiving from the British. In January 1957, an official from Pulak, whom Lippholz named as Dr. Weber, met him in Munich and told him that Bandera must be, quote, liquidated. Once the Ukrainian leader was out of the way, his aides could easily be persuaded to work for Galen. I should just put in parenthetically, this is rather interesting, we were talking earlier about about Nicaragua, and it appears that something very similar to this actually did happen among the Contras in Comandante Zero, or Aiden Pastora, as he's known, one of the people, an ex-Sandinista who was resisting the Sandinistas but refused to play the ball game the CIA's way, was almost killed by an explosion at a press conference himself that apparently was set off by his own people on behalf of the CIA, according to later later information. So this is not an unusual thing to happen among people who are supposedly fighting on the same side.
Now recall also when a Contra training manual put out by the CIA was brought to light, one of the factors that generated a lot of controversy was the fact that one of the tactics that the Contras, of course, bear in mind their connection with WACL and with all the groups we've been talking about, one of the tactics that the Contra training manual developed by CIA advised was to periodically single out dissident members and make martyrs of them for the cause. Now, one of the things that we're asking here in the course of this investigation is, did that in fact happen to Stefan Bandera, as this Lippholz defector claims?
Start that last paragraph again. In January 1957, an official from PULAC, whom Lippholz named as Dr. Weber, met him in Munich and told him that Bandera must be liquidated. Once the Ukrainian leader was out of the way, his aides could easily be persuaded to work for Galen. The PULAC official then offered Lippholz 20,000 marks for killing Bandera. They had several meetings and a plan was prepared to poison him. He took his meals in the canteen at the office of 67 Zeppelinstrasse, and Lippholz was given poison to put into his soup or a drink. The PULAC official gave him a fake passport in the name of Karl Lipnitsky, and told him that immediately after completing the assignment he could go to Austria, where Galen's agents would look after him. Lippholz stated at the press conference that he had not been able to go through with the murder of Bandera, with whom his relations were friendly. Moreover, knowing of several killings amongst the members of rival factions, he was afraid that he might be discovered and become the victim of the vengeance of Bandera's supporters. Using the passport Dr. Weber had given him, he went to Austria and then to Italy. In Austria, he heard from some Ukrainians opposed to Bandera that, quote, the Galen people had hired another would-be assassin, one Dmitry Miskiv. In October 1959, he heard of Bandera's sudden death and realized that he must have been murdered by a hired assassin. He traveled across Europe to Norway and eventually in 1961 decided to go to East Germany and ask for political asylum, although he had never been a communist. He had arrived in East Berlin a few weeks before the Stashinsky case was revealed in Bonn, and had regarded it as his duty to inform the East German authorities of what he knew of Galen's efforts to, quote, liquidate Bandera 2 years earlier. Stashinsky's confession that he was a Soviet agent, quote, was a tissue of lies contrived by the American CIA and Galen. He was a member of UPA and had been hired by Galen to dispose of the undesirable Ukrainian leader. There was not much factual evidence to support these enormous allegations, nor was any better evidence supplied by another ex-Galen agent, Otto Freitag, who had also defected and was exhibited at a second press conference. The publication of their stories was conveniently timed to exonerate the KGB chiefs from the two murders and at the same time to discredit Galen and the CIA. Okay, before I finish, I just want to mention one more thing. Just want to insert something real quickly. Again, now notice, now as far as Cookridge is concerned, that all of this stuff has got to be phony. He uses terms like enormous allegations, not much factual evidence, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Bear in mind, though, that we're talking that in the case of Stashinsky, who claimed to have done it on behalf of the KGB, he just happened to be carrying around a broken key, which just happened to have the other half of that broken key still left in the lock some long period of time after the assassination, the so-called assassination had taken place, which nobody had happened to find in the lock. Nobody had bothered to go to the apartment. Nobody had tried to open the door, apparently, or anything. And this piece of concrete evidence just happened to be sitting there waiting all this time for somebody
almost
to prove it.
Almost 2 years. Bandera assassinated in October of 59, and here we are in 1961, and the key is still in there.
That's right, and Stashinsky is still carrying the other half of it around with him, even though it's a key that would link him to a capital crime if he was arrested by the police.
And which, if the KGB got him, according to usual intelligence, or at least some intelligence procedures, they might want to get rid of him if that key would have been able to link him and through him them to the killing. That would have been a very good way, if he was really a KGB agent, to sign his own death warrant.
That's right. So Cookridge is not Cookridge is fairly incredulous about the testimony of Lippholz, but he does not seem to be sufficiently credulous. Is sufficiently incredulous about the testimony of Stashinsky.
Adding one detail, of course, we're not holding a brief here for the KGB or the Soviet Union or anything else. Because the Bandera murder figures very prominently in the Kennedy assassination, as we're about to see, we're examining the circumstances in detail and taking note of some of these, frankly, incredible-seeming discrepancies.
Okay, last paragraph here. Felfa probably had a hand in producing the two defectors. Certainly, he was busily supplying the communists with material in order to keep the anti-Galen propaganda campaign going. During those weeks, he exchanged frequent radio signals with Karlshorst, but by then he was under close surveillance. On October 27th, a KGB radio signal to Felfa was intercepted by Galen's monitoring service at Stocking. It read, quote, "Urgently require advice whether unmasking action against Galen should continue."
Okay, now remember, too, that as a result of this, Heinz Felfa, Galen's chief of counterintelligence, who was definitely KGB, was unmasked. Now, one thing to consider is whether, at least in part, the Bandera operation may have been a trap in order to do just that, to trap Heinz Felfa and unmask him as a KGB agent. His, by the way, he was eventually released from prison and just a couple of weeks ago published his memoirs. Now, keep in mind the Bandera death and some of the discrepancies we spoke about. Continuing now with the Dallas Conspiracy by Peter Dale Scott. The death in Munich on October 15, 1959, of Ukrainian guerrilla leader Stepan Bandera, allegedly at the hands of Soviet agent Bogdan Stashinsky, was exploited by Ukrainian nationalist and ABN spokesman to demonstrate the importance of their movement to the Soviet authorities, and more particularly, to oppose the growing rapprochement between the American and Soviet governments. Reading that last sentence again. The death in Munich on October 15, 1959, of Ukrainian guerrilla leader Stepan Bandera, allegedly at the hands of Soviet agent Bogdan Stashinsky, was exploited by Ukrainian nationalist and ABN spokesman to demonstrate the importance of their movement to the Soviet authorities, and more particularly to oppose the growing rapprochement between the American and Soviet governments. Okay? Later spokesmen for the American right wing sought to link Stashinsky to Oswald, some even speculating that they had both been trained at the same special Department 13 school for assassins in Moscow. Curiously, none of these spokesmen observed that the date of Bandera's death, October 15, 1959, was the date Oswald entered Russia. So that it certainly is an intriguing coincidence that the day, I, of course, recall in Radio Free America number 13, three Americans defected to the Soviet Union in 1959. All three of them repatriated in 1962. One of them was Lee Harvey Oswald, one of Marina's Russian handlers in Dallas, who we're going to look at a little later, when being interviewed by the Warren Commission about why Lee Harvey Oswald went to Russia, gave the cover story for one of the other three Americans who defected. Now, that's an interesting coincidence. Now, bear in mind here that there is an attempt by the American right wing to link Stashinsky to Oswald, and, of course, the Bandera assassination used to build up the importance of the OUN Bandera to the American authorities and to indicate how concerned the Soviets were with him and also to destroy the growing rapprochement between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Continuing with the Dallas Conspiracy. But at least one of these pro-Ukrainian spokesmen, former Representative Charles Kirsten, who had succeeded Edison as a member of the World Anti-Communist Steering Committee, alluded to earlier, began to develop the picture of a Soviet assassin conspiracy 2 weeks before the assassination of President Kennedy. And quoting here from a letter which Kirsten wrote, 15 days before he was shot down, President Kennedy was warned that assassins were being trained in Russia to commit murders in the U.S. and England. This warning was voiced in a letter former Representative Charles Kirsten, Republican of Wisconsin, sent the late President and his brothers, Attorney General Robert Kennedy and Senator Edward Kennedy. The burden of Kirsten's letter was an effort to obtain administration help in focusing public attention on the assassination of Stepan Bandera, the Ukrainian underground leader by communist agents. In urging this, Kirsten wrote, unquote, "The Senate Internal Security Subcommittee has been contemplating a hearing of the killing in Munich of the Ukrainian underground leader Stepan Bandera by the former Soviet agent Bogdan Stashinsky, whose German trial Kirsten attended as counsel for Mrs. Bandera," interestingly enough. It was a bizarre assassination illustrating the subversive operations of the Soviet police in the free world. Apparently, the State Department is trying to prevent the hearing. Before his defection, Stashinsky was being trained for high-level killings in England and the U.S. There are others in such training, according to his testimony. I have been informed indirectly that the State Department called for a delay of the hearings and may possibly desire their cancellation. Okay, so 2 weeks before Kennedy's assassination, a key Wackel person, a key person with the Wackel Steering Committee, who also happened to be the counsel for Mrs. Bandera at Stashinsky's trial, is warning that assassins are being trained in Russia to come kill Americans in America. And, of course, in our Guns of November broadcast, we looked at the extensive attempt to portray Lee Harvey Oswald as a leftist and talk about his connections with the Soviet Union, his travels in the Soviet Union. And we've also looked at the fact that he was almost beyond a doubt a U.S. intelligence agent who was being set up as a patsy.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Continuing with the Dallas Conspiracy by Peter Dale Scott. 3 or 4 days after the Kennedy assassination, a Munich right-wing newspaper linked to the ABN, the Deutsche Nationalzeitung and Soldatenzeitung, was able to publish the hitherto unrevealed story that Oswald shot at General Walker, and added to it the story that Oswald and Ruby together had been released at the insistence of Robert Kennedy. Of course, that's nonsense, and we looked at the setting up of the Oswald shooting at General Walker in Guns of November number 2. We also looked at some more of that connection in Radio Free America number 11. Either coincidentally or conspiratorially, the press secretary of the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation Steering Committee, of course that's one of the groups that resulted in Wackel, continuing, either coincidentally or conspiratorially, the press secretary of the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation Steering Committee added to the picture that Oswald was part of a left-wing assassination plot. The press secretary was Salvador Diaz Verson, V-E-R-S-O-N, president of the Liga Anticomunista de Cuba and a former chief of Cuba's military and intelligence service under Prio Sequeiras. He helped start an unfounded rumor in Miami that Oswald, while in Mexico City in September of 1963, quote, met the Cuban ambassador in a Mexico City restaurant, and they drove off in the ambassador's car so they could talk privately, unquote. Other Cuban exiles in Miami, in touch with State Department security officers, were at this time spreading rumors about the pro-Castro connections of Jack Ruby, and of course, as we looked at in Guns of November, Oswald as well. And recall also that Carlos Marcello's lawyer became secretary of what was of the Latin American CAL branch, and also Maurice Brooks Gatlin, another key member of the steering committee, hooked up with Oswald at 544 Camp Street.
And, of course, the real irony of this lobbying effort on behalf of these people, on behalf of the Cubans, the anti-Castro Cubans, was that all of Oswald's and Ruby's contacts with Cubans were with anti-Castro Cubans, both of which were documented in our Guns of November. And as we shall see later on, the irony of the pro-Ukrainians, anti-communists, that Oswald was some kind of a Soviet dupe, was that all of Oswald's contacts in America with Russians were with white Russian anti-communists, as we will see later in this broadcast.
Okay, continuing now with the Dallas Conspiracy. We shall come later to Oswald's apparent link while in New Orleans in 1963 to Americans who were in touch with the Latin American elements of the WACFL Steering Committee. Maurice Brooks Gatlin, part of a right-wing group at an address used by Oswald for his Fair Play for Cuba Committee, unquote, attended a Congress in 1958 of the Inter-American Confederation for the Defense of the Continent, CIADC, along with Salvador Diaz-Verson, Fritz Kramer, Ku Cheng Kang, he's a key Kuomintang developer of Wackel here, and Nestor Prochyk, P-R-O-C-Y-K, the chairman of the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. All of this suggests a continuity, albeit one that may be more symptomatic than explanatory, underlying the significance of Oswald's contacts with Spaz T. Rakin in June of 1962. Recall Spaz Rakin of the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations.
Okay, we're just about to go off into the strange, bizarre, and disturbing world of Dallas's white Russian community and Lee Harvey and Marina Oswald's connections with those selfsame folks at the same time that Oswald was being denounced as having been a dupe of the communists and the KGB. And we will be following those tangled and complicated trails when we come back from a short break.
That again from AFA program number 15, recorded in March of 1986. By the way, in addition to the Dallas Conspiracy, the text that was excerpted is Galen, Spy of the Century by E.H. Cookridge, hardcover edition, Random House, 1971. A couple of points, although the fact that the key to Bandera's apartment was still in the lock at the time of Stashinsky's trial. That might seem picayune, but actually a key is a very important piece of forensic evidence because keys are coded per locksmith and could yield a great deal of forensic evidence. And again, as I noted, Stashinsky, if he had really been the creature that he represented himself as being, would not have hung on to that shaft, to the key. In all probability, he was a double agent for the Gaylenorg, the BND. The notion that the key would still have been the broken head of the key would still have been in the lock to Bandera's apartment 2 years later just isn't credible. In our visits with Peter Lavenda, our most recent visit, we were talking about the old TV comedy series Hogan's Hero, and Hogan's Heroes, I should say. And the fact of the matter is the Germans are not a bunch of dummkopfs. They are not. They are very thorough and far-sighted people, very intense, and they are not a bunch of dummkopfs. Americans are a bunch of dummkopfs. The Germans are not a bunch of dummkopfs. And yet, the circumstances surrounding Bandera's killing with the key still in the lock, it almost is like from Hogan's Heroes. It's like Hogan would say, Schultze, do you realize the head of the key is still in the lock? But the key is still in the lock? I don't know how that could have happened. You wouldn't want me to tell the colonel about that. Oh, Hogan, you wouldn't tell the colonel. I mean, it's that silly. It just could not have happened. What we're going to do now is to revisit again the linking of the killing of Stefan Bandera, again on October 15th of 1959, the same day that Lee Harvey Oswald began his odyssey of defection to the Soviet Union. And note again that three Americans defected to the USSR in 1959, all three repatriated in 1962, and when interrogated by the Warren Commission, one of the Oswald's key White Russian contacts, when asked why Lee Harvey Oswald went to the Soviet Union and interrogated about the circumstances, gave the circumstances for one of the other defectors, which is highly suspicious. What we're going to do now is to revisit AFA program number 150, for the record, program 158, recorded on June 6th, of 1959, and the book that we're going to be visiting is Deep Politics and the Death of JFK by Peter Dale Scott.
Thomas Dodd's name also crops up in connection with the Kennedy assassination in another context. In addition to the possibility that Lee Harvey Oswald may have been working for Senator Thomas Dodd's committee, it was Senator Thomas Dodd who helped to provide Julian Sauerwein's Senate Internal Security Subcommittee with the disinformation that Lee Harvey Oswald was a Soviet or KGB-trained assassin and someone who was linked to the same assassination program that allegedly took the life of Stefan Bandera. Stefan Bandera was a Ukrainian fascist, the head of the OUNB organization that collaborated with the Third Reich. The OUNB not only provided the Third Reich with personnel for various Waffen-SS divisions and collaborated enthusiastically with the Nazis, the OUNB of Stefan Bandera also became a key element of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. That was a reworking of Hitler's Committee of Subjugated Nations, a consortium of Central and Eastern European fascist groups allied with the Third Reich. It basically renamed itself after World War II and became a key element of what came to be known as the World Anti-Communist League. Stefan Bandera was killed on October 15, 1959. In fact, his assassination appears to have been orchestrated by the Galen spy outfit. However, that organization, by the way, there's discussion of the Bandera assassination in RFA 37 and also in RFA Program 15, both available from Spitfire. In fact, it appears probable that the assassination of Stefan Bandera was actually arranged by the Galen spy organization, which then helped to point the finger of guilt in the direction of the KGB.
Specifically, a fellow named Bogdan Stashinsky showed up and claimed that he was a KGB assassin and that it was he who killed Stefan Bandera. Elements associated with what was to formally coalesce as the World Anti-Communist League linked the killing of Stefan Bandera with the assassination of President Kennedy. And, in fact, the Senate Internal Subcommittee report by Julian Sauerwein tended to link those two events, namely the killing of Bandera and the killing of Kennedy, intimating that Oswald was part of the same KGB assassination team as Bogdan Stashinsky. The fact that Bogdan Stashinsky had a key, half of a key, to Bandera's apartment, the other half of which was still in the door several years later, is one of a number of different aspects of the Kennedy, of the assassination of Bandera, which casts severe doubt on the KGB did it hypothesis. It should be noted, too, that the day that Bandera was assassinated was the same day that Lee Harvey Oswald defected to the Soviet Union. In fact, Oswald was almost certainly working for U.S. intelligence, and it was not, in fact, the doctrinaire communist that he made himself out to be. Whatever the reality, though, of the assassination of Stefan Bandera, his killing, allegedly by Bogdan Stashinsky, was linked by the American far right, including elements associated with the World Anti-Communist League, with Lee Harvey Oswald's alleged assassination of President Kennedy. And in turn, these attempts at linking the assassination of Kennedy to the communists became known as a Phase One cover-up. In Peter Dale Scott's discussion, many liberals and people of more enlightened political persuasion, in fact, covered up the Kennedy assassination because they were afraid that if, in fact, the public perceived that the Soviets and or Cubans were behind the assassination, that this could lead to a third world war. So the attempts at linking Kennedy's assassination to the communists were an essential element of the cover-up. It was that linking that led many liberals to help cover up the assassination as well. Even though they knew that it was not the communists, they were afraid that if, in fact, that became the public perception, and there were elements working very hard to try to achieve that, that that could lead to a third world war. It should be noted that the report linking Stefan Bandera's killing to Kennedy's killing received furtherance in considerable measure from Senator Thomas Dodd. This is discussed in Deep Politics and the Death of JFK as follows. Speaking of attempts to link the Kennedy assassination to the communists, finally, the chief press contact of the Shikshini Knights, Guy Richards of the New York Journal American, published a claim, soon taken up by Frank Capel, by the John Birch Society, and by Charles Willoughby's American Security Council, remember that last institution, that Oswald, like another alleged KGB assassin, Bogdan Stashinsky, had been trained at a KGB assassination school in Minsk. A toned-down version of the story was subsequently published by Julian Sauerwein's Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, with help supplied via Senator Thomas Dodd from within the CIA. So note that not only did Thomas Dodd help to get the Bogdan Stashinsky canard into print, courtesy of the Julian Sauerwein Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, but that he was assisted in doing so by the Central Intelligence Agency.
That began from For the Record program number 158 from June 6th of 1999. By the way, I would note, as discussed in For the Record 158, Thomas Dodd had been part of the U.S., quote, prosecutorial staff, unquote, at Nuremberg. He also, as we will see, was on the staff of the American Security Council, which was a key organization, key element of what coalesced as the World Anti-Communist League. The American Security Council was built on the files of Harry Young's American Vigilance Intelligence Federation, which was part of the Hitler-Goebbels anti-Comintern. Also, as discussed in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and as set forth in For the Record 158, in the summer of 1964, as the Warren Commission was finishing up, or was basically doing its thing, Thomas Dodd was visiting Germany, where he was helping to deflect an investigation into a guy named Julius Klein, who was basically fronting for German corporations' activities into the U.S., and as such was being investigated by the Senate. And when in Germany, he was networking with a guy named Luger, Westrick, who under the Third Reich had been a Wissenschaft Führer and had been reporting directly to Martin Bormann.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Again, of Thomas Dodd. By the way, there are other interesting Nuremberg connections to the investigation of Kennedy's assassination. The Texas Court of Inquiry was the state of Texas body put together to, quote, investigate, unquote, the Kennedy assassination. It was headed up by Judge Robert Story, S-T-O-R-E-Y, who, as Colonel Robert Story, had passed down the order to relax the denazification edict in Germany. And the other fellow on the Texas Court of Inquiry was Leon Jaworski, who also became a Warren Commission counsel, later best known as Watergate Special Prosecutor. Leon Jaworski was a member of the board of directors of the MD Anderson Foundation, which was a CIA domestic funding conduit, and he also had been on the, quote, prosecutorial staff at Nuremberg. He served on the staff that was overseeing the doctors' trial, and while several Nazi doctors who had performed lethal human experiments on concentration camp inmates were being basically subjected to were on trial, several of them were already working for Project Paperclip. Now, interestingly, the fellow who first called attention to the alleged Oswald Bogdan Stashinsky connection was none other than Lev Dobryansky, who was a key Ukrainian fascist associated with the OUNB and its top front organization in the U.S., the UCCA. Reading now from page 216 from Deep Politics and the Death of JFK by Peter Dale Scott. General Charles Willoughby, in particular, was also part of the leading defense industrial lobby, the American Security Council, along with politically active Army Reserve officers like Lev Dobryansky, who first brought the issue of Bogdan Stashinsky and the alleged murder training school to the attention of Julian Sowerwein and the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee. Skipping down. Senator Dodd was on the ASC payroll when he generated the Senate subcommittee report on Stashinsky's supposed murder training school. So again, note that Dodd himself was on the ASC payroll, ASC a key element of WACL. The Warren Commission's makeup itself was very interesting. One of the members of it was, of course, Alan Dulles, who had been fired by JFK for lying to him about the Bay of Pigs and appears to have basically been orchestrating much of the Warren Commission cover-up. Also, John J. McCloy, who had been U.S. High Commissioner in Germany and had turned loose many Nazi war criminals directly into the service of various intelligence agencies, including the Galen Org, the BNB, and through the org, the CIA. As I mentioned at the top of the program, the OUNB and other Nazi-affiliated Eastern European fascist organizations associated with the ABN and with the Galen organization, and through that the CIA and the Office of Policy Coordination, they were part of a covert operation called the Crusade for Freedom. That was a covert operation which had as its foreign component the fascist freedom fighters that we have spoken about in, among other shows, AFA program number 1, and For the Record 777. We went into it again in For the Record 465. The OUNB, along with other Eastern European fascist organizations that had been allied with the Third Reich, carried on guerrilla warfare in Eastern Europe right up until the early 1950s, almost to the end of the Korean War. War. And it had a domestic component as well. In 1948, Thomas Dewey was narrowly defeated by Harry Truman, and the received wisdom in the Republican Party was that it was because of the, quote, Jewish vote, unquote, because Truman and the Democrats supported the creation of the State of Israel. This was seen as part of the Jewish conspiracy in the United States. Dewey's campaign manager in 1948 was none other than Alan Dulles, who not only was networking with the SS, as we have seen in many programs, deeply connected to the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit, and had been directing investment into the Harriman 15, in which prominent American industrialists basically channeled investment money to the Third Reich. And he was Dewey's campaign manager in 48. Dewey's vice presidential candidate was none other than Earl Warren, although the Warren Report, the Warren Court, I should say, was very liberal. Earl Warren actually was not. He was not only Dewey's Republican vice presidential candidate. As the Republican governor of California, Warren had overseen the internment of Japanese Americans into the detention camps. And in California, that was basically the vehicle for an enormous ripoff of prime farmland. There was a large agricultural middle class among the Nisei, the Japanese middle class. And Earl Warren oversaw their internment and the appropriation of that very valuable property. Later, of course, Earl Warren was the head of the Warren Commission. The domestic component of the crusade for freedom, an altogether illegal domestic intelligence operation, ultimately evolved into the Republican Ethnic Heritage Outreach Council. That is literally a Nazi wing of the Republican Party. We went into that in, among other programs, For the Record 465. That program, and again, this will be in the documentation for this, is in, among other broadcasts, 465, and will be linked in the description for the record, 876. The head of the Crusade for Freedom was the aforementioned Alan Dulles, who, as a key Warren Commission member and having been fired by JFK for lying to him about the Bay of Pigs, Alan Dulles was almost certainly orchestrating the Warren Commission, much of the Warren Commission's cover-up of the assassination of JFK. The key overseer of the Crusade for Freedom that brought these Nazis into the U.S. and ultimately resulted in their evolution into a key element of the Republican Party was Dulles' protege Richard Nixon. Nixon was in Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1963, flew out about an hour and a half before Kennedy was killed. Then when interviewed by the Warren Commission in February of 1964, he lied and said that the only time that he was in Dallas, Texas was 2 days before Kennedy's assassination. That would have been enough to convict him of perjury because he made that statement to FBI agents and to indict him for the murder of President Kennedy. This despite the fact that in a UPI interview with Nixon in Dallas on November 21st, a day after he claimed he left Dallas, basically featured Nixon in Dallas claiming that he was going to do all he could to remove President Kennedy. We talked about Nixon and Watergate and the JFK assassination in, among other programs, The Guns of November, Part 3, For the Record, Program 253, and the miscellaneous archive show Richard Nixon's Greatest Hits. The chief spokesperson for the Crusade for Freedom was none other than Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan helped block Jim Garrison's investigation into the Kennedy assassination when he refused to extradite Edgar Eugene Bradley to New Orleans, someone wanted by Jim Garrison for his investigation. Later, Reagan served on the Rockefeller Commission investigating possible CIA involvement in the Kennedy assassination, and that commission predictably found no CIA involvement. In fact, there was massive CIA involvement, although it was certainly not only the CIA, perhaps not even primarily, they were deeply involved. There were other elements as well, including military intelligence and some foreign elements as well. When Nixon became president, the Nazi wing of the Republican Party was installed as a permanent branch of the Republican Party. Previously, it had only coalesced during presidential election years when it was seen as being able to deliver the swing vote in five key states. The person who, as chairman of the Republican National Committee, installed that branch as a permanent Nazi wing of the Republican Party was George Herbert Walker Bush, for whom CIA headquarters is named. The State Department official who oversaw the importation of these various Eastern European Nazis and fascists to become part of the Republican Party was William Casey. When Reagan became president of the U.S., we basically saw the coalescing of the CFF group. Reagan, of course, helped to cover that George Herbert Walker Bush was flitting back and forth between Dallas and Houston, Texas on November 22nd, 1963, was very close to Jack Alston Crichton, whom Peter Dale Scott has fingered as a key element in helping to manipulate the Oswald as a KGB person. Jack Alston Crichton was associated with the 402nd Army Reserve Intelligence Group, along with Deputy Dallas Police Chief Lumpkin, and also Winston Lawson, who was in charge of the Dallas Secret Service contingent. And again, the elder George Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, claims he can't remember where he was and what he was doing on November 22nd, 1963, despite the fact that he was flitting back and forth between Houston and Dallas. In fact, when he and Barbara Bush were in an airplane waiting to land at Dallas's Love Field, their landing was delayed by because they had to wait for JFK's body to be flown out of Dallas. So when Reagan, who was involved with the CFF and helped to cover up Kennedy's assassination, was elected, you had William Casey of the CFF, who was his campaign manager and then became head of Reagan's CIA, and George Herbert Walker Bush was the vice president under Ronald Reagan. A fellow named Laszlo Pastor, a Hungarian fascist who was associated with the Arrow Cross organization, was the head of the Republican Ethnic Outreach Group, and when it became a permanent branch of the Republican Party under Richard Nixon, and then when the Free Congress Foundation was involved with networking with various groups inside of the Soviet Union as it was in its final stages of destabilization, Laszlo Pastor helped to project many of these same Eastern European fascist organizations, including the OUNB, into the former Soviet Union. One of the outgrowths of that was Katerina Chumachenko, who was a key member of the UCCA. Katerina Chumachenko had been Reagan's deputy director of public liaison. She then became the first lady of Ukraine under Viktor Yushchenko after the Orange Revolution. The aforementioned Lev Dobryansky, who first called the alleged KGB's Stashinsky Bandera assassination and the link to Oswald to the attention of Julian Sauerwein, Thomas Dodd et al., went on to become Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas, and the Bahamas were a key link for not only the corporate fronts that were used to fund the Afghan Mujahideen, but also Al-Qaeda. One of the key people involved with setting that up for the Bank Altaqua was a guy named Balbin Dunant, who was a friend of, protege of, and attorney for François Genoux, who was the heir to the political last will and testament and collected literary works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. Dobryansky's daughter, Paula Dobryansky, was sat on Ronald Reagan's National Security Council, and she also became an Assistant Secretary of State, Undersecretary of State, under George W. Bush. And Lev Dobryansky was head of the UCCA, the top OUNB front organization in the United States. So again, the CFF and the OUNB and the World Anti-Communist League and the ABN and the Reagan administration inextricably linked with the people who coalesced in the Reagan administration from the CFF, inextricably linked with the assassination of JFK. This concludes For the Record program number 876, the OUNB and the assassination of JFK. This is being recorded on November 20th of the year 2015. I'm Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.